This week, October 6, 2015, on The Digital Story. Our 10th anniversary celebration. Oh my gosh. And this is episode 500. That's right. I am still ticking after 10 years. You haven't got rid of me yet. So what we're going to do today is we're going to have some fun. We are going to celebrate this milestone, this badge of just hanging in there, regardless of what happens week after week, getting this podcast out to you. We're going to go all the way back to episode 1, where I talk about flash modes, and I'm going to give you a segment from that, give you a bit, a snippet, and then we're just going to kind of work our way, you know, back to where we are now. I do little things like we make a stop in Beijing when I worked the 2008 Olympics. We talk about the introduction of the Olympus EP1, the start of it all in the mirrorless world, which has had tremendous impact on this audience. Have an interview with Tom Hogarty over Lightroom 3 beta. And Lightroom 3 is when Adobe really made its move on Aperture. And I cornered Tom at PhotoPlus Expo in New York and get him to talk a little bit about Lightroom at a time when, you know, it was kind of Lightroom or Aperture. Of course, now it's all Lightroom as we look back. And then I have some other fun bits and bobs. The last piece, we're doing 8 pieces today. The last piece will be the end of Aperture, which I thought, you know, that's the full arc of probably the first 10 years here. The introduction of mirrorless and the end of Aperture. We're going to cover it all today. It's going to be a lot of fun. Sit back, make those headphones comfortable, and let's take a stroll down memory lane. Show 001, Photo Flash Techniques, October 4th, 2005. So, this is where it all began. Now, those of you that are veterans of the show, you recognize the intro music, right? That was the music that I used when I very first started the podcast. And as you may recall, we had Scott Shepard read a little intro, and then we got into the show. The show was very different in those days. I would generally just pick one topic and then just hammer on it for like 25 minutes, you know. Now, over the years, I've changed. I've figured out that, you know, people want, you know, maybe different topics, you know, different segments to the show, you know, kind of keep things moving a little bit more and not just, you know, go on and on and on about a particular thing. But that's not the way it was in 2005. So here we go. I'm going to give you a snippet right now about flash modes. And what I wrote on the very first show notes is that compact cameras generally use auto flash as their default mode. And for most flash photography, auto gets the job done. But if you want to improve your photos to the point where they rival professional images, spend a few minutes exploring the other flash modes on your camera. And here's what I had to say about that. Man, you know, here's the deal with compact cameras especially. You see, the problem is that the flash on these cameras, because the cameras are small themselves, is too close to the lens. They have no other place to put it, right? It's got, you know, you only have so much real estate there, so it's got to go somewhere, and it's usually close to the lens. So what happens is when the lights are down low, which is often when we're taking flash shots, the flash goes off, and it fires this beam of light. And if the person's looking directly into the camera, chances are their pupils are dilated, right? So that flash is light's going right into those dilated pupils, and it's actually bouncing off the blood-filled retina in the back there, right? And reflecting right back into the lens. Just like when you shoot a pool shot, you know, and the cue ball goes, you know, straight, hits the cushion, you know, the bumper, and then comes right back at you. That's what's happening with the flash. And that's where you're picking up that red reflection. Okay. Now, the way to get around it, if you have A more sophisticated camera is that you move the flash farther away from the lens, and you change the angle of reflection, and it doesn't show up. Okay, and that's why wedding photographers often have their flash up on a bracket. One of two reasons why they do that. One is because it ensures that you'll never have red eye, which is very embarrassing for a professional photographer. And the second is it moves the shadows. If a person's standing close to a wall or something, it moves those shadows down away from the person. All right. So that's why wedding photographers often use these flash brackets. Okay. You can, if you got a compact camera and you're at a friend's party, you don't get to do any of that, right? So, so what camera manufacturers, they know that, and they got to have some answers. So what they do is they create, this auto red eye reduction. And a lot of times the way that it works is that, you press the shutter and then this beam of light, goes piercing into the subject's eyes, or even better yet, a series of flashes, boom, 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 of light flashing into their eyes. The thinking being that by pelting their eyes with this bright light, their pupils will constrict, thereby reducing the chances of red eye. So, what you get, instead of a person smiling and relaxed and everything, when the flash goes off, they've been pelted by all these, pulses of light, and they kind of got this weird kind of scrunched up look on their face, right? And then the flash goes off. And then they usually have red eye anyway because the darn thing doesn't work, okay? So just forget about red eye reduction. Don't use it, especially to eliminate red eye, because it doesn't work. Okay, that was pretty fun. That was a rather instructive, don't you think? Okay, the next segment here. This is interesting to me. This is show number 69, What's in My Bag? Recorded on February 13th, 2007. Now, the reason why I picked this segment is because, all right, way back when, in 2007, you'll hear the seeds of the nimble photographer in there. You'll hear me saying that I like to travel light and do all this sort of stuff. Now, the nimble photographer hadn't come into being yet. And of course, mirrorless cameras hadn't come into being yet. So I'm working with a DSLR. So it's kind of fun to listen to how I'm traveling light and working with my gear back in 2007. What I said in the show notes is, there's no greater satisfaction than having packed the perfect camera kit for the assignment at hand. In this podcast, I discover what was in my camera bag as I ventured out to shoot an indoor basketball game. After covering all the items in the picture above, there was a photo of all the items, I then solicit readers for what's in their camera bags. So let's take a stroll back to 2007 and hear what was in my camera bag. What's in my camera bag? That's right. We've been doing a lot of work lately. We've been talking about techniques. We've been talking about software. But, we're all photographers, and that means we all love our tools, right? Tools. That's what we call them when we're around our significant others or people that question how much money we actually spend on this craft. Now, we all know among ourselves that these are actually the toys we use to create the magic that we do. But there are tools when we're talking to outside folks. So I came back from a shoot today. I did a basketball game. And when I got back from the shoot, I opened up my kit. And it's a very compact kit because I like to work fast and I like to, not schlep around too much equipment when I'm shooting action photography. And I opened it up and I go, I haven't done the obvious show. I haven't done the show where we talk about what's in my camera bag for this particular type of shoot and then ask you what's inside of your camera bag too. So that's what we're going to do today. I'm going to talk about what's in my camera bag and then I want you to send me mail about what's in your camera bag. And I think we're going to have some fun with this. All right. So let me just start out. This is my compact kit that I use for shooting action photography. I would have a little different kit for a wedding, a little different kit for landscape. A lot of the stuff will be the same, but today I'm talking about an action photography kit. And I start out with the Canon 5D. It's a fabulous body. I just love it. 12 megapixel, full sensor camera. Takes beautiful pictures, and the basic lens that I put out, my kind of carry around start with lens, is the 24-105L. It also has image stabilization and is f4. It's a very nice lens. I don't use it for action photography so much, but I just always have that lens on that camera, and then I change as needed. Now, inside the camera, I have a SanDisk Extreme 4 4 gigabyte compact flash card. And I love these SanDisk Extreme cards. And I have a matching FireWire 800 reader for it. So this thing screams. And you know, when you're racking up these RAW files on the 5D, you really need a memory card and reader combination that will do you justice when you plug it into the computer. Otherwise, you're going to be waiting, and we all hate to wait. I mean, I want to see those pictures now. So, can you hear the nimble photographer in there? Yep, it was just a matter of time before he came out of the camera bag, right? Okay. So let's go to September 25th, 2007, and that's show 100. And I'm going to talk about the top 10 $100 photo accessories. Now, I'm just going to zoom to my number one choice, my number one photo accessory that's $100 or less. And I'm not going to spill the beans right now. You just have to listen to the bit. But I want to share a comment from the podcast. Now, as you may recall, in the early days, we actually were able to have comments on the site, which I really liked. In fact, I loved that because I just felt like that the community was closer when we could do that. And then the advent of malicious spam, just pounding our comments area. We tried everything. We tried various plugins for our blog. We tried other pieces of software. We tried monitoring it by hand. Literally for a year, I battled these guys. And I finally just gave up. And what we had to do was switch so that the conversation could happen over at Facebook. And I had to close the comments on the digital story. That, for me, was a very sad day. To this moment, I feel bad about that, and I hate it. But we just really could not figure out any other way to fight these guys. I hate those guys. You know, they talk about ruining a party. They're great at it. So before that happened, I have a comment about podcast number 100, show 100, which was a bit of a celebration in itself, from Tony. And Tony wrote, "I can't believe it's 100 digital story podcasts already. Congratulations. I've been there since the beginning. I think I first heard about your podcast on the Inside Mac radio podcast. If I remember correctly, Scott interviewed you to debut your show. Anyway, it's by far and away my favorite podcast. Your topics are interesting, relevant, and inspiring, and your delivery truly encourages a sense of community that you like. And don't worry about the production quality of those first few podcasts. I do remember those. The slickest production means nothing if you don't have good content. And good content stands on its own without any gloss. Keep up the great work." All right. Thank you, Tony. Really, thank you. You know, it's that kind of stuff, whether it comes in email or on a Facebook page or however it gets to me. You have no idea how important comments are like that. Because, you know, I'm sitting here in a darkened studio with a microphone, just, you know, doing what I hope is interesting to you. But if I don't hear from you, I don't know. I don't know if I'm on track or not. So every one of you who has ever shared some feedback with me, however you did it, I just want to thank you right now. Thank you so much. All right, so let's get to show 100 here, where I talk about my number one photo accessory for $100 or less. What could I have left off? What could be, what else is there out there? Well, there is one thing. There's one thing, and you can still get them for $100 or less. And I think this is the absolutely best $100 you could spend. And that, in my opinion, is a 50 millimeter prime lens. A 50 millimeter prime lens. A lot of times they're f1.8 or f1.7. And I think it's the best deal in photography still. You know, we all have the zoom lenses and everything that are 3.5 or 4.5 or whatever. But when you get into low light, having a fast lens makes it easy to focus. You don't have to push your ISO up as high. Your shutter speeds are faster. Everything is easier in low light with a fast lens. And to be able to get a lens as fast as f1.8 for $100 or less is still a steal in photography. I think every photographer should have a 50 millimeter prime lens in his or her camera bag. And even if you only use it once a month, the times that you use it will be times that you just couldn't get the shot any other way. And you know, imagine if you had to push the ISO up to 3200 to get the shot with your big zoom lens, and you can shoot at ISO 400 with a 50-1.8 or 800 at the worst and have, you know, better quality. Imagine, it's worth it right there. So that is my number one pick on the top 10 list of photo accessories for $100 or less. The 50 millimeter f1.8 prime lens. You can get them online for $100 or less. And that is my top choice. So if nothing else has remained constant over the last decade, it's my love for the 50 millimeter f1.8 prime. I mean, that little guy has come up over and over again. And of course, now Canon has, you know, revised their 50 millimeter f1.8, and it's terrific. And even though I shoot primarily with mirrorless these days, I bought it to have it for my two Canon bodies. I just love that 50 millimeter lens. I just think it's fantastic. And I think it's interesting on show 100 that that was my top pick. And of course, I probably talk about it another dozen times over the years. Okay, so let's get on to the next topic. Let's go to August 4th, 2008. And I'm going to go to Beijing. I'm going to bring you with me. And I'm providing a visit to the Olympic Media Center. As you may recall, those of you that were with me in 2008, I had the opportunity to shoot the Beijing Olympics. It was the chance of a lifetime for me. I was working with both Kodak and Apple, who both Kodak was actually running the Media Center, and Apple was running the computers inside the Media Center at that time. And I had a chance to work inside the Media Center with the photographers and go out and shoot events. It was just a fantastic moment in my photographer's life. So I thought, okay, let me take you inside the Media Center. Not too many people get to go there. And that's what this episode's about. That's what this snippet's about. And here's what I wrote in the show notes. The Olympic Media Center has over 200 workstations set to help journalists share Olympic moments with the world. In this podcast, I'll provide some insights about the city within the city, which will also be my home for the next 10 days. Alrighty, so let's go to Beijing. Come on, join me. Let's have some fun. And so the Media Center sort of, not only does it provide a place to work, it also provides, you know, a refuge from the elements that these guys are working in. And inside the Media Center, it's like a little city, actually. There are cafes, places to eat, a post office, you know, all this kind of stuff. So you can go in there if you have a pass and, you know, get nourish yourself a little bit, cool off a little bit, get out of the smog, and get your work done. Now, what's interesting is exactly how this whole thing is set up. And I don't think this is anything that I can't disclose. There's no NDA on how big the media center is or anything. So I'm going to actually take you inside and just kind of give you a feel for what's going on there. First of all, it's just big, big, big. And I mean, when you look at this thing, it goes on forever. And so there's a computer area. And when I say computer area, I'm talking about rows and rows and rows of tables with computers on them. And to give you an idea of what I'm talking about here, now one of the major sponsors for the Beijing Olympics is, Lenovo. And I think they're based in Beijing. And so they are providing, the PCs, the Windows computers. And there are, I think they're providing in the media center itself 50 workstations right there that they have set up and ready to go. Now, Apple is also participating, and Apple has 50 workstations set up there also. So Lenovo has 50 workstations, Apple has 50 workstations. Though part of the reason why I'm there, in fact, the reason why I'm there is that I'm there to help photographers who want to work at the Macintosh workstations use all the tools, not only the Mac itself, but Aperture that's loaded on those computers, and then just help them get done whatever they need to get done. I know photography, I know digital imaging, I know Aperture, and I know Macs, and I like photographers, so it's not a bad fit. Now, they also have set up something like 30 laptop spaces. Actually, I'm looking at this right now, and it looks more like 80 laptop spaces. So there's another, when I say a space, I mean, there's a place to sit, place to plug in, place to do all of this in all these tables. 80 spots for laptops. And then they have like another 30 spots that are reserved, and I'm not sure who they're reserved for. So there's something like over 200 positions within this media center where photographers can work at any given time. So at any given time, we can have over 200 people in there working at the workstations themselves. Now, Canon has they have an area set up here. So for consulting and for their customers, as does Nikon, and Kodak has an area set up. And then there's all the other kind of services and so forth there also, all in this gigantic room that's right inside the Olympic Village. I'll never forget my time in Beijing during the Olympics, and interestingly enough, I got to go back the following year, working for Neil Bauman on the Geek Cruises. I was in Beijing, and we toured other parts of Asia. And it was fun going back the following year when the Olympics weren't in town to see the difference. It's a special place, and working with those great photographers and just being a part of one of the most spectacular Summer Olympics ever was really a big deal. All right, so let's move on to 2009, June 16th, 2009. This is show 181, and this is the start of something that has become very big for a lot of us, which is Olympus announces the Olympus EP1, their first Micro Four Thirds mirrorless camera. Now, what I wrote in the show notes is state-of-the-art technology melded with Olympus pen tradition. The EP1 digital camera is a new breed of DSLR featuring HD video, RAW format, Micro Four Thirds, and a stylish stainless steel compact body. In this podcast, I walk you through the feature set of the latest innovation by Olympus. Now, you notice that I said a new breed of DSLR. The term mirrorless or ILC, all that stuff hadn't even been coined yet. We didn't even really know what to call this camera. So we go, well, it has interchangeable lenses. We'll call it a DSLR. And of course, it became the opposite of a DSLR. didn't it? Because, you know, that's what we decided we were going to use instead of DSLRs. So anyway, here is my introduction to the EP1. Little did I know at the time that this was going to have such a big impact on my life. And probably the same goes for a lot of you that are listening. So let's hear what I had to say back in 2009. Today, we're introducing a brand new camera, the Olympus EP1. Brand new camera, compact, removable lens, stainless steel body, little gem of a camera, shoots HD video, shoots RAW format at 12 megapixels. Really a beauty. And it's just announced today, and I have the scoop for you because I've actually been working with this camera for a little while, and I want to bring you up to speed on it because I think it's a very interesting device. Now, not coincidentally, we're really dealing with the 50th anniversary of the Olympus Pen camera line. Now, those of you that have been around photography for a while may know about the Pen. The Pen was actually introduced in 1959. That's a long time ago, even by my standards, 1959. But over a period between like 59 and 1983, they sold like 17 million of these things. They were really popular, and they evolved. You know, there was a whole lot of different models, over 15 different models, and they evolved into an actual compact, removable lens, half-frame camera. So they were quite the big deal in their heyday. So that all started 50 years ago. Now, it ended in 83, and then Olympus, you know, went on to do plenty of other things during that time. So coming now to the 50th anniversary of the Pen camera, and thanks to the innovations that have happened since the original Pen ended, namely the Micro Four Thirds system in digital photography that Olympus has been a big part of with Panasonic. So, you know, bring that forward now, and we have a brand new camera. We have a brand new camera that we are going to talk about today, and this, as I said before, it's the EP1. So, you know, I was thinking about it. If I look back over the last 10 years and think about what are the things that happened over the last decade that really had a positive impact on my love of photography, I would have to say that mirrorless cameras are at the top of the list. I would say between that and the iPhone, those are the two things that have really brought a lot of joy back to photography for me. So it's very interesting that, you know, this Olympus camera that was announced then, and I was so lucky. I mean, Olympus, I had been doing a little bit of work with them prior to the mirrorless thing. And then, you know, they tapped me on the shoulder and said, hey, do you want to help us usher in this new era with this Olympus Pen? And they took me to New York, and they put a camera in my hands, and we went out shooting, went to Coney Island, stuff like that. And then I had all my content ready for the announcement, and I was, you know, one of the ones that got to debut this camera. And in all honesty, things haven't been the same ever since. And I mean that in the most positive way possible. Okay, let's go to October 26th, 2009. And let's have a visit with Mr. Tom Hogarty of Adobe. At the time, he was the Lightroom Senior Product Manager. Now, he's moved up a notch or two. But Beta 3 for Lightroom had just come out, and Tom and Adobe, they were very excited about it. So Lightroom 2 had done quite well. It was Lightroom versus Aperture. There was a lot of discussion. It was like Canon, Nikon, Mac, PC, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, Adobe was really pushing hard on Lightroom. They wanted Lightroom to be the best. They wanted Lightroom to be at the top of the heap. And they really felt like that this version 3 of Lightroom was going to get them there, that they would eclipse Aperture, which they did. And of course, not only did they eclipse Aperture with Lightroom 3, they never looked back. They never looked back. Aperture never made a run at them after this. So here we are in New York, and I cornered Tom, and I asked him about this beta. And it's just interesting as we look back now to listen to his words and everything. Now that we know that Lightroom won, and now that we know it, you know, what kind of app it became, to hear what he thought about it back in 2009. Tom, this is a pretty exciting week for you guys.
Very exciting. We always love coming to the Photo Plus Expo, and it's great to be able to share the news about Lightroom Beta 3.
I think the great thing about Photo Plus is there are so many good photographers here. I mean, people that are right in the sweet spot that can really appreciate what Lightroom is bringing to the table right now.
Absolutely. I kind of cut my teeth in the industry working in New York with all the professional photographers, and I love coming back and seeing what they're up to and how styles have changed and how people are changing photography.
So I want to talk about Beta 3 because this is definitely the news right now. And I have some, you know, we're going to talk about a few inside things. But before we get to that, we should probably just give people the usual sort of beta caveats, you know, just so they go into testing Beta 3 in the right frame of mind.
Definitely. What we've done with this beta is we actually changed it a little bit relative to the beta for Lightroom 2. And we're releasing it earlier than we have in the past because we want to make sure that we have time to incorporate feedback. So it's a little bit rough around the edges.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie. So if you're working with it, we want you to test with it and use it and give us feedback. But I wouldn't use it as your primary workflow at this point. Just go ahead and work on a copy of your images during the beta period.
Well, and that's the exciting thing, too, because, I mean, the neat thing about it is that everyone that uses it and gives feedback and so forth, you're actually helping to shape this application for its final release.
We actually did a few things before we released the public beta to react to feedback. We've been compiling a long list of things that photographers have been looking for in the application. And we went through that list and said, you know what? What can we crank out in a day or less? Photoshop team has talked about this before. They call it a Just Do It item or a JDI. So what we did is we found all these JDIs that we were like, okay, we can knock these out in a day or less. And we ended up with about 35 of them in the Lightroom 3 beta. Things like changing the background color of the print module to black instead of white, adding collections to the develop module, little things like cleaning up the aspect ratio and the crop tool, cleaning up the develop panel and the adjustment brush. So little things that took less than a day, but I think will have a big impact for our customers.
I think that's what's interesting about them. They're little things in terms of, you know, maybe product development, you can do them fairly quickly. But in terms of user experience, some of these things are tremendous. I mean, for instance, I was telling you earlier that one of my favorite things is having collections available to us in the develop module. That little thing has a huge impact on easing the workflow.
Yeah, I have to agree. Another little thing, my personal favorite, is I often hide my panels when I'm in the library view, and I'll just go ahead and mouse over to scroll the grid down to look at a different set of images, and I find that right-hand panel will flip out on me. I've heard a number of photographers talk about this. So we actually changed the behavior over there to make it a little bit more forgiving. So if you're reaching for that scroll bar, we're not going to come out right away. We're gonna give you a second, make sure you want the panel to reappear versus you want to scroll the grid. And it's a little nuances like that, I think, that will help our customers.
That's great stuff. And actually, you gave me a nice segue. One of the things I wanted to ask you is, I mean, you're a product manager, you know this thing inside and out, but you must have some favorite features, some things that, you know, you personally are, you know, where you say to yourself, I am so glad we were able to, you know, get this in version 3. Can you share a few of those?
Yes, I can. And I try not to influence the development cycle with my own personal favorite things, but one topic that I think has come up for me in the last year or two is the presentation of images in a video format. I've seen some stellar slideshows from really great photographers, and the one common theme is that they're all in this really graceful video format with music attached to it. So the slideshow export, I'm going to be using a ton because we'll just go direct to H.264. I'll be able to put these things on my iPhone, upload them to my video storage site. So that, I think, will make a big impression for my own photography. The other thing is just performance. I never like to see that little loading bezel as I scroll from image to image. I want to see my image. And so the fact that I almost never see that anymore, except right after initial import, makes me very happy.
Those are two great ones. I have to second, especially the slideshow thing. I'm very excited about that. And I think it's a great way for photographers to bring out their artistic side in the sense that they think about a collection of images, how they flow from one to another, putting music. I mean, I think it forces us to really look at our pictures, and then to be able to share that so easily is fabulous. Okay, this next show number 363, on Feb 19th, 2013, is called No Camera For You. And I don't know, it's always been one of my favorite shows. And I think it was definitely a listener favorite too. And of course, the title is a play on words from the soup Nazi on Seinfeld, where he would say, no soup for you. You know, if you did something wrong while you're waiting in line. And so No Camera For You is a play on that, as probably everyone figured out, at least anyone who's ever watched Seinfeld. But the idea was that, of course, you know, this day and age, these new cameras come out all the time. And I just want some of them. And I think the one that I'm referring to here, we'll find out when we listen to the snippet, was the first release of the RX1 or the RX100. I forget which one. But it was the Sony full framer, the first one that they did in a compact body. And it was expensive, and I didn't have the budget for it, and I never did get it. And this episode talks about wanting that camera so badly, knowing that it's too expensive for me, and then a little bit about how I cope with it. So let's tune in. Let's go back to February 2013 and listen about No Camera For You. What do you do when you're jonesing for a new camera, but you really can't afford it? How do you deal with that? This is something that I know I am not the only person going through. Now, this started... okay, so I'm going to fess up here, right? I have to. So here's what started this topic for me. I published on Tuesday. On Monday. On Monday, I published a piece by James Duncan Davison, where he reviewed the Sony RX1, the Sony RX1. This is a camera that I really like. I want this camera. I want this camera more than I've probably wanted a camera since the Olympus OMD. And just in case you don't know anything about the Sony RX1, what Sony did was they put a full-frame sensor, 35-millimeter sized sensor, in a compact camera, and then they put a Zeiss 35-millimeter f2 lens on there. So what you have is this camera that fits in your jacket pocket that has a Zeiss f2 lens and a full-frame sensor, and the sensor is killer. It's just a beautiful, beautiful sensor. In a camera that costs $2,800. Now, it's not just the $2,800 for the camera. It doesn't have a built-in electronic viewfinder or any kind of viewfinder, actually. What you have to do is compose on the LCD. It's a beautiful LCD, but it's an LCD nonetheless. So you have to compose on the LCD. Well, I don't really like doing that. I mean, sometimes I like doing that for special occasions, but most of the time I like looking through a viewfinder. So they have two viewfinders. They have electronic viewfinder and an optical viewfinder. And I think one is $500 and one is $600. So let's just say we add the $500 one onto $2,800. Then you have things like a lens hood for $170. And, you know, it goes on from there. So that $2,800 investment quickly becomes a $3,500 investment, $3,600 investment. You need another battery, right? You're just not going to walk with one battery. So now we're getting close to $4,000. And that, the $2,800 is actually, I shouldn't do that, in all honesty. I shouldn't do that, but definitely not $3,500 or $4,000. Not this early in the year with so many things that could happen. I have to save my business budget for, you know, important stuff. But I love this camera. I mean, I'm jonesing for this camera. And, you know, James Duncan Davison did not help, because I know him and I know the type of photographer that he is, and he loves this camera. So he did not help by publishing this wonderful review. So I thought, okay, if I'm going to go through this, then I'm going to share my coping skills for not buying a new camera when every fiber in my photographic body wants to, and I know I shouldn't. Okay, number one, here's how I have five coping skills here for this scenario. I'm not sure which one I'm going to do yet. Maybe we'll, after I go through the list, I'll fess up on maybe which one or ones I'm going to do. But number one, get a new lens for a favorite camera that you already have. Now, this is not cheap either, right? In my case, it would be probably a new lens for the OMD. So that's not as bad as if I got a new lens for my Canon DSLR. So I could probably get off for $500 on this. $500 is a lot better than $3,500. I can absorb $500 this early in the year. So, and if you've been through this, you know that a new lens will make you fall back in love with your camera, your existing camera, because everything just looks different. So something, even in my case, I could do something like that $299 fisheye I've had my eye on for some time. Maybe if this RX1 thing doesn't go away soon, maybe that's what I do. I spend the $299 on the fisheye, put it on my OMD, go crazy, and forget about the RX1. Coping skill number two, break out an old camera and fall in love with it all over again. And this has actually worked for me before. I have quite a few cameras around the shop here, and I usually only shoot with a couple at a time. And so I have some very good cameras that I don't use a lot. And this is especially if I allow myself to get into film cameras. I have definitely some digitals that I haven't shot with regularly, but I have some fantastic film bodies too. So one thing that you can do is break out a camera that you already have and start shooting with it. And then you get that feeling of, you know, you're working with a new tool. You're seeing the world a little differently. You're getting different images. You know, a lot of the things that you want from the new camera, you might be able to get from one that you already have. And this brings us to July 1st, 2014. So this show, you know, we laugh, we cry, we do all those things. I mentioned that the mirrorless debut was one of the highlights for me over the last decade. Definitely one of the darker moments was when I actually got a call from Apple PR telling me that they were ending Aputure and iPhoto. And I mean, you know, we had suspected as much, we had heard the rumors and all that, but like so many things, that when you actually have someone telling you, this is it, we're pulling the plug on Aputure, you know, I'm just sort of in shock at the other end of the phone. Just go, I mean, when? Just like, now, this is it. Run your post right away. Here's the scoop. We're giving you this. And I have to tell you that since that moment, my relationship with Apple has not been the same. Everything changed. The person that I was working with, the product manager for professional photography apps, he moved to a different department. And, you know, we had a long time relationship. And we were friends in addition to everything else. So he moved on. And the new person and I did not hit it off very well. And they got mad at me because they didn't like the way that I handled reporting the news about the end of Aputure and what Photos for OS X was going to be able to do for us. And I felt like I was just reporting the facts. And, you know, and I... didn't feel like I was spinning it one way or another. I was just trying to get the word out. And to this day, I'm still upset about this. I just don't understand why a company that has not millions, but billions in the bank couldn't keep probably what I consider one of the best photo applications of all time going, even if it was just on life support. So this is the podcast on July 1st, 2014, where I break the news to all of you. And what I wrote was in the show notes, Apple halts development of iPhoto and Aperture, migrates users to new Photos app. Aperture users have these three basic options: do nothing, switch to Lightroom, or migrate to Photos. I talk about all of these options in today's second segment. And here's a bit from that show. Okay, story number two. Let's get to the big deal here. Apple halts development of iPhoto and Aperture, migrates users to new Photos app. So basically, here's the deal. You know, we haven't really seen a major update to Aperture for some time, and for iPhoto, for that fact. I mean, really, the last big thing that they did was create the Unified Library, which was a big deal. And I think that creating the Unified Library actually allowed them, that was a step towards this step, which is migrating to the new technologies in macOS X Yosemite, which will be seen here before too long, and the new application they've written, the new Photos app for Yosemite. And what they really want to do, and you know, this is actually what I've really wanted them to do, which is move forward with their photography tools on not only the Mac platform, but the iOS platform, and then iCloud integration. In other words, bring it all together. Bring it all together is what I've been waiting for them to do. And I thought that when they released OS X Mavericks, I thought that we might see a new version of Aperture then, because I thought, well, finally, things were in place enough to where we could have iCloud integration and iOS integration with Aperture and iPhoto. I thought Mavericks would pull that together. I was off by one. Yosemite is actually going to be the one that pulls that together. And I'm sure what happened was when they sat down at the table and started looking at everything that they wanted to do with Aperture, with iPhoto, with iOS, with iCloud, with macOS X, that they felt that trying to patch Aperture and iPhoto would be more work than it was worth, and that it would be easier and over the long haul smarter to write a new app from the ground up. And I wasn't sitting at the table, but I'm pretty sure that's the way the conversation went. And I'm sure it was a difficult conversation, because whenever you discontinue two beloved apps, such as iPhoto and Aperture, you know that there's going to be a firestorm around that. You know that there's going to be a lot of negative publicity, that you're immediately going to lose customers to other applications, namely Adobe Lightroom would be, you know, at the top of that list, and that you probably hurt the trust factor a bit in terms of your existing customer base. So it's not something that you do lightly. I'm sure they didn't do it lightly. However, it was something that they probably felt that in the end, the pros outweighed the cons, and that a few years from now, all this kerfuffle will have settled down, and we will all be merrily taking advantage of the new photo technology that Apple has to offer. So what does that mean, though, for those of us that are using Aperture and iPhoto? You know, it boils down to really have three basic choices as you're thinking about the future. And I want to emphasize thinking about the future, because you don't really have to do anything right now, and you don't really have to do anything even when Yosemite comes out. Because one of the things, probably one of the last things that Apple's going to do is provide an update to Aperture so that it runs smoothly on Yosemite. And, you know, what Apple is saying here, not that they're taking Aperture away. In other words, that they're not going to discontinue it in the sense that it's not going to work on Yosemite. They're just really not going to develop it anymore. And in all honesty, they haven't developed it for some time. So the first thing that I say to people who are getting a little nervous about this is, well, you have been using a static Aperture for some time now. And all Apple has done is made, you know, this situation official. So you don't have to do anything right away. That is one of your options, which is just to wait and see what happens. Aperture will continue to run just fine on OS X Mavericks. It should run just fine on OS X Yosemite. Apple doesn't provide RAW file updates just for Aperture or iPhoto. They provide them for OS X. They work on Preview, Aperture, and iPhoto. So my guess is that they're going to continue to create RAW file updates that will be system-wide. Aperture and iPhoto should be able to take advantage of them, at least for the time being. And then, of course, the new Photos app and Preview and whatever else happens will too. You might not even be outdated if you're waiting for a RAW profile. I'm waiting for one, actually, for the Olympus OMD EM10. They haven't provided that RAW update yet. I would like to see that sooner than later. And I'll take a nice deep breath once that shows up. So you can just keep going along. So, of course, we have moved on since then. Although, for a lot of us, we still don't have the final solution. I know I'm testing Aperture on El Capitan. Seems to be going fairly well. I've only found one major bug so far. So it looks like there's a stay of execution. I have been learning Capture One Pro, which can actually look into Aperture libraries. Probably the most intelligent migration that I've seen to date, other than moving from Aperture to Photos. Photos for OS X has extensions now, but they haven't really done much on the front end for those of us that are power users. So it's still a very interesting time, and you know, it's still going to be a topic that we'll be covering in the future. So Dibs has joined me in the studio now. I opened up the door. You know, Dibs, the studio cat. So you may hear a little something from her every now and then, but I thought I'd let her in. It's her dinner time, and I didn't want to deprive her. So my recording room up here is also Dibs' room, where her food and her water stuff is. So, you know, we share this particular room at the studio. When I leave, she stays and kind of watches over things for me. I think what I want to close with now is just a thank you for being with me for all these years. It's incredible. I mean, when I first started this show in 2005, I used to say, well, what am I going to come up with every week? How am I going to keep, you know, fresh topics, you know, flowing through the microphone here? And I really didn't know how long I was going to go. And I had no idea that I'd be able to go 10 years. And a lot of that has been fueled by you, for your appreciation of the show, your loyalty, the things that you write me, coming and see me when I'm, you know, making public appearances. All that has had a tremendous impact on me, and I thank you for that. And I intend to keep going. We're going to do show 501, and we're going to keep going from there. And I hope you stick with me, and I hope you tell your friends. And if there are things that you want me to cover or things that you want me to do differently, send me a note. Let me know. I want to keep this podcast as fresh as possible and, you know, springboard it into the next decade. But for now, I really want to tell you thank you for your support, and I so appreciate it. I also want to thank our podcast sponsors, and, you know, they're a very patient group. You can tell by listening to most shows that, you know, there are ads up front, there are ads early in the show, all that kind of stuff. Things that I have never wanted to do with The Digital Story, and it's better for the podcast sponsors if I put those pieces up front. It's better for you, I think, if I don't. And because you have continued to support the various sponsors, you know, they have continued to let me do it the way that I want and still, you know, continue to support the show. And so I just want to give a shout out to our sponsors right now because, you know, they're special. They're different than a lot of other advertisers out there on the web. And I want to start with the longest running podcast sponsor, which is Red River Paper. Drew and Company, this paper mill in Texas. I met him through a mutual friend, Rick LePage. And, you know, Rick said, you ought to talk to these guys because you're cut from the same cloth. You know, they are passionate about photography. They love what they do, and they really care about their customer. And I did meet with them, and we have been together ever since. And I just cannot speak highly enough of the company or the product. And Red River Paper, as I've mentioned before, they have a Facebook page at facebook.com/redriverpaper, and they have a tile on all the pages of the digital story. And then our second longest running sponsor is Sizzlepix. And Don Sherman, who I fondly call Mr. Sizzlepix, is he's a very special person also. He is a photographer. He loves photography. He was done with his career in advertising and was retired and learned about this startup and was just captured by it, just loved it and saw the potential for it and really started a second career, even though he really didn't want to start it. He just wanted to kind of ride off into the sunset with his DSLR. But he has worked so hard to make Sizzlepix what it is, which is sincerely the finest printing on metal that you can find anywhere in the world. And they have been a great sponsor of the digital story. And they have a tile on all the pages of the digital story. And you can visit them at sizzlepix.com, sizzlpix.com. I don't work with people that I don't believe in. And believe me, I believe both in Don and the product. Lynda.com is probably our third longest running sponsor. I've had a relationship with them since Aperture 1 when I first started recording titles for them. And then about a year and a half ago, probably, they became a sponsor of the podcast too. And, you know, again, they let me do it the way that I want. If you listen to Lynda.com spots on other podcasts, you'll notice that, you know, they are much more formal, sound like they're written by the marketing department, all that kind of stuff. They don't make me do it that way. I said I wanted to do Screening Room. I wanted to highlight the content. I wanted to provide something that I felt was useful to our listeners. And they've let me do that. And I really appreciate it. And I love working with the company, and I love having them as a sponsor. And then our newest sponsor, Zenfolio. And my catchphrase for them that I'm going to stick with, I think, is that if you want your site to look as good as your photos, visit zenfolio.com today. And that's Z-E-N-F-O-L-I-O. And they are new to me, and I've been exploring them and trying to learn about their service. They're an online portfolio and client fulfillment site. You can do a free trial with them and, you know, build your site. That's both a storefront, and then you can also use it to deliver images to your client, not only on the web, but through mobile devices. It's very intelligent. It's very refined. It's very beautiful. And it's also affordable. You can get started with them for $60 a year. And for people who are freelance photographers or starting out their careers, this is a good place to, you know, to show your wares. And you can grow with them as your business grows. And I just think they're terrific. And I look forward to working with them here in the near future. So I'll have a little longer spot about them next week, but right now, zenfolio.com, and I'm thrilled to welcome them to our family of sponsors. That's it for today. I think we have covered it all. Next week, we are going to delve into El Capitan for photographers, Mac OS X El Capitan. I'm going to release the new workshop schedule for 2016, and we're going to get back to work. I'm really happy that you joined me for this celebration today. And, well, let's meet again next week. Until then, have a great week. Bye-bye now.